Well, I hope you feel refreshed and everything after this morning and the lunch. Danny's very generously said that we can record, so I'm going to record what's going on this afternoon. Just before we start, I'm going to say what happened. When Danny arrived in Paris this morning, his phone was pickpocketed. And so he had experience with the French police. I won't repeat what he said on the phone, but I think you're going to be dining out on anecdotes about the French police when you get back home. And I think you're going to tell us maybe what you were doing last night and why you couldn't be with us earlier either. So we're even more delighted because he's managed to squeeze in coming to us after being at an event last night, and he's going back this evening, back to Oxford, so it's not... So we'll have to have you back for a more relaxed and less interaction with the police another time. So let's formally begin then this afternoon. So as you can see behind us and in front of us, we have Professor Danny Dorling with an extremely long academic career that at the moment you're at the University of Oxford, and you can see behind all the different posts and positions he's had with being a specialist in geography. And if you go to his website, which I really advise you do, you can see many, 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 many of his publications. And that David has cited about housing, that I've cited, that's actually, funnily enough, your name is in my PhD booklet about how to reference. I cite one of your things about young people. But anyway, as you can see, this list is incredibly long. And so, yes. So I hope you have a rest on the way back this evening before tomorrow. But the reason why we are here today and why he is today is to talk about Shattered Nation. Here's the book. We've passed it around. We'll pass it around again. And so I think I'll just leave it to you because you're much more interesting things to say than me talking about all the marvellous things you've done. So thank you very much for your being very generous with your time.
Thank
and
you.
Squeezing us in when you didn't have to.
And I did have to because I do have to get out of Britain every so often, which I think you understand more than most people because you're here. Why? It is quite nice to get out, if you can, every so often, of Britain. It's quite funny you scrolling through the books because I was having an argument with a colleague about myself and the name my children call me. And he said, oh no, you're not that at all. They said, but you have written 20 books about the same subject, so you're not exactly normal, are you, Danny? And if you were choosing to write about something in hindsight, you wouldn't have really chosen to write mainly about Britain, given how the story has gone over the last 30 years. And I'm going to maybe annoy you. I'm definitely going to stop in 35 minutes because I'm much more interested in what you've got to say, and I'll try and do short and truthful answers. But I'm going to annoy you a bit, I suspect, because I do some comparisons between countries, and these comparisons are statistical. But you can also do anecdote. And so my anecdote from 11:40 this morning is that just as I was telling my colleague who just arrived from Brussels that this was the most dangerous point at which you could be pickpocketed, and they can confirm this, exactly 2 seconds later I felt a hand in my pocket, and 1 second after that I watched the young French policeman push the man to the floor and arrest him. I then get to see lots of young French policemen and women, one woman, and marvel at the shaving of the beards and just how good looking they were. I felt grown up because I had made the decision myself not to do anything about this and just lose the phone. You know when you've got old when you make that decision. It's the right one to make. Went to the police station, you may have been in it, the special police station for pickpocketing in Gare du Nord. It's really modern, it's clean. It's not like the one you might go to in London, which I've also been to because I'm an absent-minded academic with a high chance of being pickpocketed. So it's different. I've got far too many slides to show you. They're really just a backdrop, but you can have a PDF of them if you want. This book has no graphs in it at all, for two reasons. One is that people do not buy books with graphs in them. And the second is that if you saw the graphs and skimmed through the book, you might just think I cherry-picked, because they can't all be as bad as that. So I stuck 150 of them up on the website for Shattered Nation, and they're just background. We haven't got enough time to go through them, but it's a comfort blanket for me. I'm not making this up, what I'm going to be telling you. Last night, I was talking to people involved in government who are worried about what's happening, and they're in government. Because what's happening is not good. And if you had amazing eyesight, you could see this first slide. There is good news. When I do this talk in England now, I start with a 20-minute story about some good news, because I find if I do 35 minutes about the story, it's actually quite hard not to cry. But there's good news. What this slide shows or is about is that all of our pay deals in the last 18 months to 2 years have been progressive for the first time in decades. 2019, the Communication Workers Union, which is a private sector union for British Telecom, which is now a private sector company, gave a flat 3%, I think, across the board. Inflation was about 2%, it's 1% for everybody. But if you're a highly paid, normally male, telephone engineer, you're going to get more money because your salary is already higher. So a 3% rise gives you more, and if you're at the bottom, you get less. Not so autumn last year. The most complicated tier pay deal. Well, take civil servants in the UK. Top level civil servants have seen their pay decrease in real terms by 25% since 2008. Bottom level civil servants by 12%. They're all worse off. But for the first time in decades, the gap is narrowing. This is clutching at straws. This is last kind of few years. But it's across the top. MPs took 2.9% at a time when we had inflation running at 10%. Last time when MPs showed any restraint was during the cost of living crisis that occurred between about, get it right, when about 1931, 35 is there. Our current cost of living crisis, by the way, began in 2008. It's almost become the longest on record. And by record, we're good at records, so our records date back a long time. The only cost of living crisis that's longer than the current one in the UK actually began before it was the UK in 1798, and lasted 24 years before real wages got back to what they were in 1798. We're now on track to beat that. Yeah, forget the 30s depression, forget other things. This is bigger and longer. Shattered Britain begins with a story about the roundabout I grew up in from the age of six. Well, I grew in one of the segments of the roundabout. And when I wrote the book, I was a bit worried that I was maybe telling too bleak a story. You know, the one useful thing in my working life is that my worries have mainly been, am I overestimating or over-egging how bad it is? And then two or three years later, no, I wasn't. But I didn't predict things to be as bad as this. Why am I this strange person sitting in front of you? You'll see five colours around that roundabout. Those are the colours of the official index of deprivation. I happen to go up in one of the few places in Britain which has a very, very wide variety of people living different lives. I was involved in the year 2000 in a big debate in geography about what are the effects of areas, neighbourhoods, as opposed to the effects of individual characteristics. And I went back to the roundabout, and I went through the subway under the roundabout, and somebody had just graffitied, bad puppies this way, good puppies that way, pointing to the different areas of the roundabout. And because school children know it really matters where you grow up, and it isn't about yourself. Right. And there's the cover of one of the books, Bankrupt Britain, done some time ago. again, I'm going to assume that you know a lot of this, and also that unless your eyesight's brilliant, or you're very young, which tend to be correlated, you won't be able to see this. But essentially, the UK was an incredibly equal country. When my family moved to be round about, the most equal it had ever been in the history of the UK. The second most equitable large country in Europe to Sweden. I grew up in a Nordic country called England. Quite incredible things had just happened. We'd introduced a health service, which partly helped, along with being so rich, to mean that we had a higher life expectancy than anywhere else in the world, apart from six countries that, when combined, had a smaller population than us. Infant mortality was lowest in the world where I was growing up, and particularly in the city I was growing up, because we had the first baby incubators. We introduced a system of social housing, which meant that a majority of children born in 1946 lived at one point or another in a council house. Whenever you hear an old person from Britain tell you, I grew up in a council house, don't you know? And then, well, it just means they were normal. The majority from the 1946 birth cohort studies were in a council house. This form of housing was copied around the planet as a way of doing things. We desegregated our schools just before I was a child. We got rid, long before many other places did, of tests at age 10 or 11 and dividing people, sorting out the weeds and the chaff, the old eugenic idea that some are going to be scholars and some are not. And then it all went wrong. Late 70s, probably a little bit before Thatcher in 79, huge increase in the 80s in inequality, and then flatline. And that's really important. And the flatlining began with John Major, and that's important. Wasn't Tony Blair. Wasn't, more importantly, Gordon Brown. I'm not going to say anything else about Tony Blair. Gordon Brown did not manage, through his policies at any point, to reduce inequality by more than 1%, and 1% was the size of the error in the sample used to measure it. Gordon Brown moved a million children over a poverty line which hardly any of their families noticed, because if you move just over a line, you don't notice you've moved over a line. We have told ourselves a history of recent politics in Britain which I think is very wrong. And it's about time we actually... New Labour put in a lot of double glazing, which really mattered. And they were embarrassed about it. So they didn't say, we've actually refurbished the social housing stock. They increased health spending a bit, not by as much as we actually needed for an ageing population or to catch up with where we were, but by a bit. But you can see where my politics is going to go, or a level of bitterness. I got annoyed with Gordon Brown this summer because I wrote an article in The Scotsman about how successful the Scottish child payment had been at reducing child poverty. And he wrote an article 3 days later saying it was irresponsible. And then Scottish Labour told him not to, which was quite nice, right? So there were lots of signs of progress. Here's my first one designed to annoy you. Maybe, maybe not. It's all too detailed as well. OECD, income inequality statistics, Gini coefficient. Income inequality is by far the most important determinant of other things. It correlates highly with them. You can have quite high wealth inequality in a country. Doesn't actually appear to matter. I think because when you have low income inequality, you actually control the rich. You say, yes, you can own that estate, but other people have got to be allowed to walk over it, but you own it. You can't own all the newspapers. So there's the UK and where it sits. Only Bulgaria has a higher level of income inequality than the UK. We surpassed Western Europe in 2009 when we beat Portugal. Turkey's above, but the majority of those little orange lines are actually going down slightly. Social scientists never write about good news. They never write about the years in which the far right in Europe falls. Right. All your lives you'd have been told about the rise of the far right in Europe. Endless story about, oh, look what's happening with the Front National, look what's happening with Golden Dawn in Greece, which are all terrible. But what you don't get are the stories about when they fail and fall away. The circles are countries in Europe. On the edge, you've got Russia, very unequal. On the western edge, you've got the UK, more unequal. Down In the bottom southeast corner, you've got Bulgaria and Turkey, pretty unequal. There are kind of interesting parallels. They've all got these oversized cities, London, Moscow, Istanbul, far too big for the place they're in, oversized because of the center of former empires, British Empire, the USSR, the Ottoman Empire. There are historical excuses. And in the middle, and I promise maybe this won't be the last time, I'm just trying to get you to think of questions. You've got what I'm very tempted to call the Nordic 15. And why am I going to call it the Nordic 15? Because the five Nordic countries are in the middle of the distribution of those 15 countries. There are five countries in Europe now which are more equitable by income than Iceland, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, and Norway. Five or more. And there are five which are almost as equal as Finland, which is my favourite country. And they include France and Germany. And that's staggering. Picture of Finland with my co-author, Anika. Speaks multiple languages, has better grammar than me, has a higher sense of morality than me, made the book twice as large as I wanted because it had to have every fact in it, and was 21 years old. That's Finland for you. We wrote a book about what's good about Finland. There's your distribution of inequality in that bar graph. You can't see the names of the countries, but on the far extreme, you've got South Africa, Israel, Russia, UK, dysfunctional, divided places. And the black and purple line are France and Germany. There's four grey lines, and then the red one is Finland. That near. Doesn't mean you can lose it all. Doesn't mean it's a utopia. Doesn't mean everything is wonderful. Does mean historically unprecedented. By the way, I should say my colleague Ben, so I do work with lots of people. That's why there's lots of books. Collaborative. Makes much more sense than being competitive. Very simple. If you're wondering why the colour scale on that map is all red, Ben refused to use two colours on the grounds. And Ben's from, well, Switzerland, Germany, and now professor in Iceland, but he's currently on the west coast of New Zealand. Ben said none of them are equal enough that they don't yet deserve another shade of colour. So he's going to shade them all in red. Right? So I'm not saying it's great, but we haven't in our history seen things like this. I'm going to have to speed up, so I'll just click through these fast. The UK has three large growth industries. One is higher education on the overseas students, which I don't talk about too much because I could upset my colleagues. But the anecdote I always use is that when I worked at the University of Sheffield for 10 years, we brought in so many overseas students that the export earnings, which is what the fees are and the graduation hotels are, the export earnings of Hallam and Sheffield University in South Yorkshire were greater than the entire metal trade of all of South Yorkshire. And before you think, oh, deindustrialisation, there's no metal trade left, that's our arms industry. Right? It's the word we use for the arms industry. We do have an arms industry. Although France has just beaten us. So not all is wonderful. Gambling. The UK is now the world leader in gambling online. Not as relative terms, absolutely. And of course, casino unregulated by Europe banking. Or as we like to call it, the Edinburgh Accords. Right. We've just taken the bonuses off the bankers' pay again, which they don't like. Because it means only a quarter of bankers will now do really well and three quarters are going to get slightly less.
Oh.
Yeah. A quote, 2002, at a private dinner in Hampshire, Margaret Thatcher was asked what her greatest achievement had been. She replied, Tony Blair and New Labour, we forced our opponents to change their mind. She thought it was a private dinner, somebody recorded it, it's published in Conservative Home. This is the European elections of 2014. And it's Europe where you've shaped every country according to how many people voted Conservative. With the definition of Conservative being the European People's Party, the largest bloc in the European Parliament. And the importance, if you want to know where are European Conservatives, they're everywhere. You know, it's part of human. Let's not get into why we're like we are. Except the UK. There were no Conservative voters in the UK because we didn't have a Conservative Party in 2014. Our Conservative Party left the EPP around about 2010 or shortly after, and by 2014 was aligned with a group which included an Alternative for Deutschland. We had, in the European Parliament before we left, by far the largest number of far-right MEPs, UKIP and Conservative. Really bad news for the European far-right when we left. All those think tanks in London are no longer in the EU. They have to rely on the Adam Smith Institute in Warsaw. Right? It's quite a come-down to do. I don't want to sound unpatriotic about it, but there is a kind of necessity when you've got 24 of your local authorities have gone bankrupt and another 24 are going to go bankrupt by Christmas and the roofs are falling from the schools and infant mortality was declared as rising yesterday and I can go through. There becomes a necessity because the things that are going wrong are accelerating that you just stop being polite. Well, if you're English, you think you stop being polite. To people outside of England, you still sound like you're being ever so guarded and polite, which might be part of our problem.
Yes.
Here's our public sector just being chopped away on the route to a night watchman state. Two estimates of how many people work in the public sector by ONS, it's all going down. Public spending, and these are the last graphs I want to go through in any detail. There's only three of them. Here's public spending, it begins. That's 1980, and so if you look, it's rising overall because we're not completely and utterly callous, right? You've got an aging population, a population requiring more things in general, slightly, but mainly because of aging, but slightly higher demands on what should happen to 3- and 4-year-olds. Your GDP isn't rising that much, so actually, if you're going to keep things the same, you've got to increase as a proportion of GDP. But the first thing to say is overall that's going up. It's currently sitting around about 42% of UK GDP is paid on the public sector. This isn't me, by the way. I work in a university, we're private. It is now further education colleges, which were nationalised last year, quietly, at a stroke of a statistician's pen. Further education colleges, which are where you go at 16, 17, 18, 19, they can include higher education. A bit like community colleges in the US. Large numbers of young people go to them, the most underfunded sector of education. ONS, this is the official story, ONS decided that because they were getting so much of their money from the state, they couldn't really claim to be private bodies anymore. And declared that they are now part of the state. And on the same letter, same day, every further education college got a letter from the Secretary of State for Education informing them that they were now part of their department. That none of them could borrow money from today onwards without permission. And implicitly, but never explicitly, their heads can't be paid more than the Prime Minister. One of the crucial things about being part of the state is it's quite hard if you're part of the public sector to say I need to be paid more than the Prime Minister. Right? It's quite hard to make the argument about why, do you? Which is why universities in the UK are so desperate not to have this happen to them. And why it would be so wonderful. But it could only happen for the same reasons that happened to further education colleges. If you actually get to a point where the whole thing is looking so dangerous, because the FE colleges were borrowing so much money because they could, because they were private, that it looks as if they're going to crash and fold and you've got to stop it. Margaret Thatcher cuts. That's your first one. The lovely John Major. Sorry, not that great, but often underlooked. 1997, landslide victory. The promise was to carry on Conservative spending for 2 years. They did, goes down. That's the spending on the health service under Brown and Blair, except half of it was paying for a war, which needn't have happened in the Middle East. That jump up is the 2008 banking crisis and bailing out the banks. That's George Osborne, the weirdest, strangest. I'm careful with my words. I know I'm being recorded, so I'm careful, but I'm very happy in court to defend saying that George Osborne is weird and strange. Vindictive. Worse than the Tories in the 80s. that spike up is COVID. Okay? And the great thing about these statistics, and you get them from the International Monetary Fund because every country in the world tells them to the International Monetary Fund, is that the IMF want to know what you're going to do in future. So you don't have to listen to the politicians, you just get the numbers, and that's what's coming. That's our cut. But I like graphs too much, but you can guess the reason for why I'm showing you this. This is the four large countries of the mainland, and you're at the top. You're the blue line. We don't ever think we're going to be France. Germany is where you aspire to be if you're British. France is just this kind of ridiculous utopian dream that you could possibly have that high a public sector. But you'll see that all the four lines, blue is France, green is Italy, black is Germany, and Spain is orange. You'll see that they all do the same kind of jumps. You know, the banking crisis happened everywhere. It was just worse in the country that decided to put all its eggs into banking. COVID happened everywhere. It's just that you already had a fairly good functioning health service. You may not have thought you had, but believe me, compared to what happened where we were, you did. And we can count it for the mortality. You'll get higher mortality because you've got more old people. Germany had four times as many ICU beds and respirators per head at the start. Finland, of course, beats everybody. They've been stockpiling PPE since the 1950-1957 flu pandemic, because the Finns are very careful. But these differences are enormous, which is also interesting. It shows what is possible. So I sit in debates where people go, oh, we can't do that. It's not economically possible. And the nice thing about being British is you can just put up a graph like this and say, well, it is. I don't know what you do if you're French, because you're at the kind of a top, but clearly nothing goes terribly wrong. If you were to suggest increasing public spending to the level of Germany or just below it, we had this unbelievably naive politician who wanted us to be like Germany and idolised the policies of somebody called Merkel over what we could do. And in the 2017 manifesto, him and his colleagues put forward spending plans that within 5 years would get us a fraction below Germany. I did it again in 2019, and it was said, oh, you can't do that. You can't be Germany. Going to put in, can you see the little orange line for Spain is actually below the UK early on in the early 80s? So we haven't always been the lowest spending. Going to put in the rest of Europe, apart from Ireland and Switzerland, because Ireland and Switzerland have GDPs that are very high for particular reasons to do with America and pharmaceutical companies. And now we've got two lines in the 80s where people used to spend less than the UK a long time ago. It was Spain shortly after Franco, and the other one is Greece shortly after the generals. It's only possible in countries without a democracy to actually carve things down that high. And Belgium, France, Finland, Norway are your top four at the moment. Moves around a little bit, but enormous differences in what size of the state you can have. What is state? What is private? Now, I'm not even going to describe these because I've got 5 minutes left. I'm just going to click through and say there are lots and lots of graphs and lots about left behind areas. But all the UK is left behind, right? The book I've written, I'm just going to click through them. I'm going to click through Stephanie Flanders telling the British people that the poorest fifth of people in Britain are now poorer than the average poorest fifth in Eastern Europe. I'm going to click through telling you that a majority of children with a brother and sister in England now go hungry two or three times a week, where hunger is proper hunger, not just being in peckish. We haven't had that since the 1930s. I'm going to click through making my joke about the Revolution Foundation's graphs and how much effort they put into producing 20 different bars for the reality to be so simple there was no need, because only one group is winning at the moment. And I don't have time to tell you about wonderful things like the price control on cheese toasties on the beaches of Greece, or how it's possible to do all these kind of things that we're told in the UK are not possible. Originally, we were told they weren't possible because of European law, which is why we had to leave the EU. And now we're just told it's not possible. People have to starve. This is a silk print of the Universal Credit Regulations, 17 feet long, if you're wanting. £85 a week if you're single. Professor Sir Michael Marmot claims that's 70% of what you need to be able to survive. Lowest unemployment benefits in Europe.
Stop.
Bob back?
Yes, go please.
Lowest unemployment, I'm not going to go through lowest unemployment benefits. Not good. About £10 a day, less. The middle class don't claim unemployment for you to... Your child is a tech entrepreneur or is doing a startup or something else. You look after them yourself until they manage to get a job or something else. It's fascinating how many people in the UK do not know what benefit levels are because they couldn't... That's for the little people. Although for the rich, they say that mortgages are for the little people. Most people only dream of being able to get a mortgage. Eurostat graph of regional inequalities... the highest bar is the UK. The bar is split because Eurostat couldn't fit the UK on the graph because we're so unequal. You can't see which is the second highest bar because the rest of Europe is so similar in a way. Everybody gets excited. There's a line that goes through France that's very important and another one through Italy and so on. But, you know, in terms of world leading... Our north-south divide beats anything you can imagine. Let's just skip through it. Because it's depressing, and I'm determined not to end with depressing. All the divides. But like I said, there aren't any left-behind areas. This book begins with the city of Oxford, one of the richest, most successful cities in the UK, with a car plant which is 1% of our entire manufacturing earnings in Oxford. Thanks to the Germans and the 1,200 wonderful robots, and the fact we just paid them 75 million not to take it to China. But we have these incredible divides, which are very similar. This is Sheffield. We've ethnically cleansed the middle of Manchester. You just sort of see the stark divides. All these are census maps. You can do them yourself. Anybody in the world can now type in UK census map, ONS will come up. And the divides are really stark. And I'm not quite sure, you know, you're grown-ups. Imagine, what do I do with 18-year-old students with this? How do you... I mean, obviously I'm not this cynical and it's slower and, you know, we're talking a 12-week course and let's make it last hours till they're really bored. But how blunt are you? Now, what stops me worrying about this is that my granddad, I'm a posh boy, my granddad went to university in 1935. Not any university, he went to Oxford. Not any department, he went and did geography at Oxford. Why am I telling you the story? Because around about 1937 or 38, he was told that war was coming. Because the boys could be told. You weren't to tell the others, you certainly couldn't let the scout or cleaner over here. But they were told that war was coming. And it's thinking about that, which means that it's okay to tell people how bad it is, because we are very probably not getting a war. So previous generations of students have had to face much, much worse news than telling them your country is bankrupt. And at the moment, nobody anywhere near power has a clue what to do about it, or even actually recognises how big the problem is, or thinks that saying going for economic growth just begins to sound a bit hollow. Right. Happiness is what we need, so we're going to get away from management consultancy. That's the biggest... I told you the growth sectors, but the biggest occupational increase, anyway. And you can see the graphs kind of go down, and they're not good. And the computer's frozen, which might be a good thing, because that will force me to be on time. No. Oh, it's coming. It's come back. You're unlucky. I'll go through that one. This is a graph from the Sunday Times. Now, one way of interpreting this graph, this is a change in funding I'm sure you know, but 7% of our children go to private schools. We spend about 30% of our secondary school budget on those children. It's where I suspect the majority of geography teachers in the UK work. Can't get the numbers. 93% of children go to state schools, but there's a huge divide amongst the state schools. There's a huge divide amongst the private schools. This graph is put up to kind of show, wasn't Labour good before 2010? Because the two lines went up next to each other. But remember, your private school funding is beginning 5, 6, sometimes 12 times higher per child than your state school funding when this graph begins. So if they both had a 30% increase, that's a huge amount of money per child for the private school ones. There's a very famous speech, which is a speech which Nelson Mandela gave before the judge had to decide whether he was going to hang him or not. So it's a kind of on the edge of your seat speech, because this man was given this speech before discovering his sentence. And if you're a social statistician, the fascinating thing about Nelson Mandela's speech is that one of his major complaints about what's going on is the education spending difference in South Africa if you're white or black. And he quotes the figures. And they're almost the same as England now, but for private and state schools. And then, of course, since the coalition government came in, because I haven't mentioned them yet, the Liberals helped the Conservatives do all of this in 2010, just in case you thought they were nice. State school funding goes down in real terms, the private school funding zooms up. So, I'm going to go through health, I'm not going to go through the pandemic. Reasons to be cheerful. David Cameron, shortly after coming to power in 2010, said he was going to make everybody happy. He flew with a huge expense of carbon to either the Arctic or Antarctic, I've forgotten which, doesn't matter, the one that's got huskies. And he hugged the husky, and then he flew back. And he talked about big society and said he's going to make us all happy. And he told the Office of National Statistics that they had to record our happiness so that they could check if he was making us happy. David Cameron, of course, like all of them, went to Oxford, my university, and apparently went to the place where you get happy on the Cali Road. Can you imagine, poor, they're my age, this is my, right? And I'm a posh boy, well, I've told you already, I'm a posh boy. But these boys, even posher than me, wearing their silly gowns in the same city I'm growing up in, were being ever so daring and going, and it's pathetic. And hardly anybody who was a teenager, when I was a teenager, liked Margaret Thatcher, but they did. I mean, that's part of the oddness of what's going on. ONS asked people, how do you answer the question, do you think things in life are worthwhile? If any of you have been to the doctor and have been feeling down, you might recognise some of these questions as a standard bank. What's your level of life satisfaction? There's various others. Do you look forward to things in the future? I won't go through them, you won't be happy for that. And the standard happiness question, which is all things being equal, or all things considered, how happy are you from a scale of 0 to 10? The reason, by the way, that Finland has been the happiest nation in the world for the last 6 years is that the Finns listen to the all things being considered part of that question. Go, well, having thought about it and how things could be and what I've got, I'm 7. It rose. The happiness index was going up to 12, 213, 214, 215. And you might think, given this terrible story that I've just told you, well, that doesn't make any sense. But remember, we had this banking crash in 2008. We get this change of government in 2010. It's no longer a government that necessarily will support wars abroad, and they're going to do something different. Obviously, quite a lot of people were happy because they'd voted them in. In fact, anybody who'd voted Liberal or Conservative should be happy because they got both of their men with no tie and cufflinks. That was the kind of new look of 2010 to 11 to 12. And then other things happened. In 2015, The Conservatives win outright, not expecting to do so. They'd made a promise that they would hold a referendum if they did. They decided they were going to hold a referendum. This made a lot of people happy in the UK. A lot of people wanted a referendum. A lot of people wanted to get out of Europe. At the same time in 2015, that weird, strange, idealistic man who I rather like became elected leader of the Labour Party. And 500,000 people joined the party, the biggest social movement in the continent. And then we had a referendum in 2016. And you might think, well, that would have dashed all the hope. But there's nothing. You can't see the result of the 2016 referendum on this. This is the ONS measure, monthly of happiness. Nothing. Because of course we knew. We thought we knew. Oh, we'll just do what they do elsewhere in Europe. You know, if people give the wrong answer, it's only advisory anyway, we'll hold another one or we'll ignore it. And then we began to have a battle, 2016, 17, 18, 19, about this issue, which became the most important issue. And the people who wanted to leave became increasingly happy because it looked like they were going to win and there was Nigel Farage on the telly all the time. And the people who wanted to stay became happier. We became the country of Europe that was most in favour of the EU. And the people who might think of themselves as more woke and into can't we be a bit more progressive, or, you know, in the British version, like Germany, well, they were happy because they got the most incredible election result in 2017, the biggest swing to Labour per year that has ever occurred, because 45 occurred over 10 years. It's four times higher per year than the 45 swing. It was unbelievable what happened in 2017. Theresa May lost her majority. And then they begin to dip. If you could see, they're going down. That blue line is February 2020, when we first realised, and you might think you were clever and knew beforehand, but honestly, you'd had to be a genius, that weird little virus in Wuhan wasn't going to be like SARS, i.e. 30% death rate, you control it because otherwise you're all going to die. It wasn't going to be as mild as cold, the common cold virus now. It was going to be something in between, which is rather bad news. But the onset of the pandemic was not as bad news as Boris Johnson becoming Prime Minister for the mental health of the people of Britain. You know, it is staggering, these numbers. I'll give you one more just to, you know, the anxiety, you know, the official government measure of anxiety. You can see it falling, then you can see it kind of flatlining in those years of turmoil. We're actually not that anxious compared to where we've been in the past. Measured, clinical measure. And then 2019, spring, summer, autumn 2019, the levels of anxiety in the British people on average as measured go sky high, higher than ever recorded before, accumulating in whatever it was, December the 19th, 2019, with the pandemic second wave just beating it. The second wave. The time when you realise, oh no, this thing's going to go on and on and on. So it's a different story. No group has won out. Everybody's left behind. My favourite pensioner, at the point at which the light was supposed to shine through him and he had just ascended, it had just been placed on his head and he was going to be the conduit between the subjects like me and them above. And the expression, it's worth looking on YouTube and just looking at his expression during those seconds of the happy feeling didn't come. Sorry, we're a monarchy and very proud of it. By the way, the reason we have non-doms, the richest people in the UK, is we introduced non-dom status during the French Revolution for the aristocrats from here to encourage them, those who didn't need any more encouragement to come over from France. Come to Britain, you don't have to pay any taxes. That line is the average income of pensioners, which did rise. New Labour did make pensioners who were incredibly poor a little bit better off by 2010. We have a triple lock, so why does it not go up? Because it took away disability benefits and other benefits in line with any slight rise. So even our pensioners have not become, on average, for the median pensioner, not better off. Meanwhile, this is what's going on in China. You might have heard about our highly successful high-speed train line. It was nice this morning, coming on a little bit of high-speed line. Anyway, it's going to go to Birmingham. Good luck. Let's go through. Let's not be bitter. And let's end with happiness. Just two more slides, so please think. Incredible things are going on. I could do lots of positive stories. The most positive of all is what's happened in Scotland. Many, many things in Scotland. Controlling of landlords, evicting people, sense of solidarity, harder to measure. But when the cost of living crisis hit, Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister at the time, convened the COBRA committee, the emergency committee that had met during COVID, and they met every week for the cost of living crisis, because actually it's more important in terms of years of life lost because of affecting younger people. And they introduced what's called a Scottish Child Payment. This was originally a payment of £10 a week to children under six if your family received any form of benefit. The trick is always getting it in. Once you've got it in, like student fees of £1,000, bang, you can, you know. In November of last year, exactly a year ago, they raised it to £25 per child for every child in Scotland who is under 16 whose family are in receipt of any form of benefit, which is 2 out of 7 of all children in Scotland. They've had that money for a year now, that's 3,900. No child in Scotland goes cold or hungry, unless their parents fail to collect this. Or, you know. Income inequality for children, which is a weird concept, but income inequality from children in Scotland in 1 year moved from being almost identical to England, apart from they got child benefit on the third child, to being nearer to Finland than anywhere else in 1 year. And it doesn't cost very much because it's only £25 per child per week. And it happened in the UK. And it's not tapered. You don't lose any other form of benefit because you get this. Right? Highly successful. Wales is now trying to see if it can do it legally. The Westminster government hate it. Absolutely hate it. Hate the idea of children not going cold and hungry. Why? And this is the saddest thing. I'd much rather one of you studied this and not me and try and work it out. I've got a horrible feeling that the underlying theory is that to be productive again, to be number one in the world again, which is, of course, our rightful place and where we should be, because The Origin of Species was written in the UK and it's all about genetics, and clearly we were destined to lead and something went wrong. And I'm not really joking. You can go through speeches. 2015, George Osborne, follow my economic plan, and by the year 2030, we will be the richest large country in the world by per capita GDP. George Osborne, 2015. Boris Johnson's resignation speech. If you follow the economic plan, even though I am gone, and he gave another quote. It wasn't the same one. It was a different one about how we'd be the highest. And then Keir Starmer. Vote Labour, and we will have the highest growth rate of the G7, and, you know, Sunit Upland will be around. This same, we'll be number one, we'll be the best again. Whereas Scotland, I think, has possibly achieved in the last 12 months the biggest reduction in child poverty seen anywhere in Europe since 1989. Right? That's something to be proud of. Last slide. So, quote from Raymond Williams, it's in the making of hope practical rather than despair convincing that ways to peace can be entered. It's easy to talk about despair, and it's easy. So what I want to try and avoid in questions is, please don't ask me about how much worse things could get. Right? Because I could do that. Well, USA is the short answer. So let's try and avoid those questions. And just because you have hope doesn't mean it's going to happen. But if you don't actually think it's possible, to get better, or you don't know what better is. If you do think that 90% of the people are the great unwashed who will never amount to anything, and to be world leading you need to unfetter 10%, you know, you're onto a loser from the start. And so those are the things that I think just one person think need to change. I am honestly pretty hopeful. But half of that is a cynical statistician's hopefulness, which is that when you are in the bottom of 30 countries by numerous rankings, even by randomness, on average, it's quite hard to stay down there. You know, you actually have to work very hard. And every other country in Europe has to not slip up and make a mistake for the UK to keep its position on so many things at the moment. Unfortunately, I'll end on this, we've helped the rest of Europe not make a mistake because we've demonstrated what happens if you leave the EU and you've got a land border. And Greece has got a land border with Bulgaria, right? As far as I'm aware, there is almost no calling to leave the EU now. And there are a number of things like this where I can be optimistic and say, well, one of the EU 28 was going to leave, because it was actually a democratic union. It was a choice. You didn't have to be a member. Somebody would have left. It could have been Greece. It would probably have been a small country. And that place would have suffered terribly, you can now tell in hindsight. So there's some kind of historical karma over the country which invaded more countries than the rest of the world ever and caused more destruction to stable social systems and had the biggest empire the world has ever known, being the one that left the EU and demonstrated it was a bad idea. You know, and given that somebody had to do it, given we're so rich still, given we've got huge structural problems of social class to sort out that we've never sorted out, even in those heady days of 1974 when we were the second most equal, we still had Eton, we still had Oxford, we still had our upstairs, downstairs, although we had no servants at that point. They're coming back. Right. So there are lots of things that are very wrong with the UK and particularly with England. And sadly, I would never have wanted the way for it to improve, to wreck it all. But that's where we are now. And the question is, what will a generation who are younger than Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer and Hunt and Sunak and whoever the leader of the Liberals is that I forget, what will they do when they realise that what they're entering into over the rent they'll have to pay, what they'll be able to afford, the precarity of their lives, what are they going to do when they don't swallow the excuses anymore about why this was all just due to world events and it's happened everywhere? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for the talk and for finishing on a positive note of sorts. There were lots of links to what we heard earlier in the day today about inequalities, child poverty in Scotland, mental health. So you're pulling together some of the strings that we were talking about this morning, obviously. I've got some questions, but I think it's only fair to let people in the room ask first. Would anybody like to start? I like to start with a woman, usually. Any women in the room who would like to ask a question first? It's a political study. Okay, so that's going to be me then.
It's a problem when you work with very strong women.
It's proven that if a woman asks the first question, more women ask questions afterwards. And so, you finished on talking about hope, and I work on young people and things related to their and their political participation. And if on this quote, if you don't think there's hope, because this is obviously the first generation in many generations that were promised a better future, that are not going to have a better future. In France, there's a great word called déclassement, that they are not having social mobility. And in your book, you talk a lot about universities, and it's interesting about the geography of where universities and where students are. Could you say a bit more about non-students?
Yeah.
I didn't tell you I was going to say that. It's something about the 50% of young people that don't go to university and don't get all that debt. Where's the hope for them?
They're nailed down to 35%. Because we have now the highest, we have 65% of people going to university at some point below 30, the highest in Europe. Mm. It's a marketing operation. It's a business.
There's some horrific statistics in the book, if you want to.
That. In a way, that's one of the ones where the hope's begun earlier. So I think you have to go back 20 years for the graduate and undergraduate divide to be widest in income. And it's been narrowing for 20 years. Now, of course, graduates are still paying more than non-graduates, but it's getting smaller and smaller. There is absolutely no way, other than Britain becoming number one in the world again, that our graduates, who are now 65% of our population, can earn enough money to pay their debts off. So they're not necessarily going to be getting mortgages. Now, for those not going, there's a very wide range of inequality in them. It's this country of inequalities. So there are people with small businesses, with white vans, who are in the top 10% and may only be 30 years old. And there are people doing free jobs who are getting by on nothing at the bottom. But they are increasingly all in it together, because a degree, the value of a degree is less and less, particularly in the UK. It just means you've been to university. It doesn't mean it was particularly hard for you to get in, given that 65% go. And as a basic rule in Britain, and I have to be careful here, but I'm not in Britain, for any educational qualification you pay for in the UK, you tend to get. So if you pay for private education, you get A's. Half of all our A grades at A level go to private school children. If you pay for a degree, you pass. You might get a 2-1, very occasionally a 2-2. If you pay for a master's, you pass. Education stops being education when you pay privately for it, because why would you pay privately for something that you might not get? And that's one of the fastest ways of actually devaluing that supposed graduate advantage. So, in a way, there is hope over getting us away from this idea that people so privileged on the planet that they can go to university at 18 and spend 3 years studying should somehow be compensated for the fact that they weren't washing floors or cutting up carrots or whatever else you might be doing. It's just ridiculous. There really shouldn't be any graduate premium. At all. You know, somebody isn't going to say, oh, I'm not going to go to university then and learn to be an engineer if I'm not going to be paid more in future. You know, I want to drive buses instead. This is common across Europe. So we have these surveys of young people, and in general the surveys of young people come out showing they're increasingly not racist, they're increasingly liberal on sexuality, they're becoming nicer and nicer and nicer. They think the planet's going to end, but except for one thing, young people who've gone to university believe they should be paid more than young people who haven't, even in the most progressive European countries, simply because they've gone. Of which the one that annoys me the most are doctors. I'm very happy, by the way, paying doctors more than anybody else. Somebody's got to be the 1%. Right? And if you're dealing with a job which involves what doctors have to deal with, fine. But the idea that you should... But you can have a really narrow income distribution and still pay doctors the most. The idea you have to compensate somebody for having spent 5 years learning the most valuable skill a human being can learn, which is how to save the life of another human being. Our thinking has gone wrong in lots of ways. And that's not just my country. The nice thing about the UK is it's gone wrong so far that these become rather simple arguments to make.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, if I may answer the question. Thank you very much, Daniel, for your stimulating presentation. This is a question on housing, as you might expect. I was just wondering, in your opinion, to what extent a change in a housing policy could help mend this shattered nation, especially in places where I think the roundabout is located, maybe Barton, Barton in Oxford.
So tomorrow night I'm talking in Oxford with the current councillor for Barton, who is no longer, as of 2 weeks ago, the chair of the Labour group of Oxford, because she's independent, because she's not white. I won't go further into what's going on in England to do with this war, but it is staggering. Some things are really easy, and they've been promised in various manifestos. So currently we have a housing law, basic tenancy law, that means that you only get a tenancy for a year. But after a year, you can be evicted with 2 months' notice and no reason, and no controls on rents. They can be whatever you want. Rents at the moment are going up the fastest they've ever gone, and have been the highest they've ever been, because the landlords can't cope with the cost of living crisis, they say. In the King's speech, even this government said it's going to not allow no-fault evictions, so a landlord's got to come up with a reason. I have to increase the rent by this much. Labour did promise rent regulation. We don't call it rent control, but we're getting very near to rent regulation, rent control coming in. Simply because the middle class are about to be evicted. Our children. We got a health service in 1948 because the middle class couldn't afford a doctor in 1938. We got rid of grammar schools and made them more comprehensive because the middle class couldn't afford to send their children to private school anymore. Some of them. How's that get rid of grammar schools? But when you could afford to send your child private, it's fine to get them to take the 11 plus. If they fail, you send them private. If they pass, they get the state free education with the clever kids. So most progressive things that have actually happened in Britain have happened for the benefit of the middle class and happened to have benefited the working class at various points. So I think that's possible. The other one is simply very large taxes on second or third homes just to raise money, and actually working out who on earth owns this property, which is really well hidden. And the great thing about property is you can see it, right? It is physically there. So although legally you may hide it, you can't actually put mirrors around the thing, right? So it's not Ireland. When the Troika told Ireland that they had to raise money because Ireland had followed our advice about banking, Ireland managed to log all its properties within a year, create what's called a cadastre. And then introduce the tax, the Troika land tax, which was progressive in Ireland, in a year. In Britain, it said it will take 500 years to do it. Well, it's obviously rubbish. So lots is possible, but it's getting to a point it's going to have to happen. Because we can't have middle class children on the streets.
Thank you. Any more questions? It's a question from Andy Moncobus-Smith.
Hi. Following from what you're saying, I work on the National Health Service and I'm interested in health inequalities. But as we know, they've been getting a lot worse, I mean, since the 1980s, and they were already quite big with, you know, the Black Report and what we know from the Black Report. So where can the good news be with this? I mean, we all know the cause. Health inequalities, you know where they come from, where they are there, but I can't see the good news, and nobody else seems to be able to see the good news, you know, countless brilliant reports being written, but no action. So do we have to wait for the tipping point, or the middle classes? The tipping point is life expectancy, which is falling, as we know. So just, you know, be interested in having your thoughts on this.
It could have been good news. We bailed out all these private hospitals during the pandemic. They would have folded. We didn't have to do anything. You could just step back and go, you're private. And they would have gone bankrupt. And then you take over the buildings. But we deliberately preserved our hierarchical structure, and we have private accident emergency beds in the middle of London now. So for everything you can go private. There's some very sad good news that we never talk about, which is that the majority of the COVID deaths were to the upper middle class, because it was by far the most age-graduated disease we've ever seen. So most of the people who died were over 88. Now in Britain, you'll know that there's this 15-year class difference in life expectancy. The working class don't get to be 88. So actually, the pandemic was a very fast, very quick leveller, which resulted in a very quick transfer of money and a housing market boom. What appeared to be a housing market boom, we called it the flight to the suburbs and the villages, but those houses had to be empty. Right. Anyway, now, what we're getting now is greater equality, but not what all those reports would have wanted. So if you go to John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, Saturday morning, you will see the trolleys going all the way out to the front. No, it's Sunday night it happens, because families look after their almost dying relatives during the weekend but have to go to work, so they bring them back in again by car. Now, they're mainly very old. So again, it's the families of the better off. And the difficulty is that there's an ideology amongst Johnson and Co., which came out in the COVID inquiry this week, which is, so what if great Aunt Edna dies early? Well, I'll put it one other. I can remember when, in the 1980s, this hospital only had 8 intensive care beds. This is the one in Oxford. And they were almost always full. And they're mainly full of road traffic accident victims in intensive care beds. There was no private intensive care. So if Margaret Thatcher had been in a traffic accident on the way to Chequers, she would have gone to the same intensive care bed. And I'm absolutely sure that the health service would not have chucked somebody out to let her in. You know, they wouldn't have done. They wouldn't have deliberately not given her a bed, but they wouldn't have helped her. And the problem is that the ideology from then was, it's okay if our own people die. And that's what the COVID inquiry is actually. You know, who do you think were in those care homes? They still mostly own their home. On average, you're only in a care home for 2 years. Right? It's old, upper or middle class people. So we're getting an increase in health equality that we're not talking about, because it's a bit painful to do, and it's not the way you'd want to get it. In the same as saying, top civil servants being a quarter poorer and lower 12%, but this is what happened in the 20s and the 30s when this last happened, when Britain last became more equal. It was pain for everybody, just more pain for those at the top. They lost the country houses, they lost the servants. Life changed utterly at the top of Britain between 1920 and 1940. Just destroyingly, utterly. There's a kind of politeness where we don't talk about that. So by far the best book to describe the history of Britain in that period is Brideshead Revisited, which begins with a young man called Sebastian turning up at Hertford College with his scout. You bring your own servant. This is 100 years ago. And the story of these young men in Oxford, and then ends with one of the young men leading the soldiers to create a military hospital in the ruins of Brideshead at a time when almost the last servants were going. That's our period of gaining equality. It was before the war, not after, most of it. And it requires life to utterly alter at the top of society. Currently, the top 10% are taking 40% of everything. So the reason why the Guardian newspaper so hated Jeremy Corbyn was because advocating becoming Germany if you're at the top of the Guardian, means that your sons and daughters cannot go to North London Collegiate School. You cannot dream of having that second home anywhere near Tuscany. The second skiing trip is off, but you've worked hard for it, remember. You've worked hard. You've written all those articles in The Guardian about how terrible life is, and couldn't we be a little bit nicer to each other? So The Guardian went for Corbyn because, and in effect supported Johnson, and in effect supported Brexit in 2019. Because The Guardian, The Telegraph and The Times were worse, but the point was, when you lose The Guardian newspaper, you know and they know it now, because that was The Guardian in 2019. Yeah, they won't let me in very often because I do say this. There's a chapter in the book, chapter 8, which is largely dedicated to The Guardian. But if The Guardian were a better paper, Britain wouldn't be like it was. And The Guardian was an amazing paper in the 60s and 70s. It's a rambling answer, but this, from outside, this is a fascinating country to study right now, right? It's just a little bit difficult if it's, you know, if you can only speak English and it's the only place you've ever lived and you're probably going to be there for the rest of your life, you know, because you don't really want, there's not an objectivity to what I'm doing really, right?
Okay, except just to finish, except I think with nearly 8 million people waiting for an operation or something like that, and we're talking really about the middle classes.
Yeah.
And I was interested in what you were saying about the tipping point. One question is why don't we reach the tipping point with the NHS, since so many middle class people are affected, because we can't really afford private health.
Okay, quick answer. The tragedy is 1 in 10 of the entire population last year, not of people who need healthcare, 1 in 10 of everybody, did cataracts, hip operations. So you've got half the middle class were paying for it and jumping the queue over the other elderly middle class. So it's
for some operations.
For some that are cheaper, not for anything that's serious. You've only got a few weird old lefties who say that I will happily die on the 3-year waiting list rather than ever go private. You've got to be very strange and obsessive to have that particular political belief. My dad was an NHS doctor and was cut off by his father, who was a private doctor, for joining the evil NHS. But essentially, for people of my social group, they will all use private. Or there are Oxford colleges where it's included in your pay, where the student's £9,250 is helping to pay for the private health insurance of their tutors. Yeah. But only some colleges. Only the richer ones. And then what happens is that my colleagues in the poorer colleges in Oxford complain about how terrible it is that their college doesn't have private health insurance. See, you can see how solidarity can do, like, dissolve. Yeah.
David showing me his watch, so we've arrived on a bit, but I think we can say thank you very much to Danny, and we have a very short break.
Yes.
I thought you told me to stop.
Yeah. Because we have a break now.
We can take another question, or we can have a break, or whatever. We can do what we want.
We run away, but we can have another question.
Well, I could tell you one more fact. One last story. One last story, very short story that sums it up. Just the city of Oxford, or my obsession. But I was born there, I worked there. So we used to have a football ground called the Manor in Headington. And what is now on that football ground is a brand new private hospital. Right? If you want to sum up Britain, your football ground, which used to be working class only, now the middle class go to football, has become a private hospital only for the upper middle classes. Built on it, and that's it. That's what's changed. Yeah.
Anybody else?
We can discuss things over a break with Danny.
Yeah.
Give it a minute.